The art of being is the art of knowing yourself, of accepting and existing in harmony with yourself, and of living out the highest possibilities of your nature. It includes three basic concepts: self-awareness, self-acceptance, self-assertion. Self-awareness concerns your ongoing needs, desires, emotions, values, aspirations, capabilities, mental states, and behavior. As you continually extend the boundaries of what you experience as the self, you take in more and more of what you had previously overlooked or repressed. Self-awareness is not obsessive. Cultivating access to the self does not mean you take your mental or emotional temperature every 10 minutes. Perhaps the single most important step in moving toward self-awareness is the realization that it is necessary to do so after a lifetime of being taught to respond primarily to the signals of others. With self-acceptance comes your willingness to experience the facts of your being at a particular moment. This doesn't mean that feelings have the last word on what you do. I may not be in the mood to work today. I can acknowledge my feelings, experience them, accept them, and then proceed to work. I will work with a clearer mind because I have not begun the day with self-deception. Self-acceptance is my refusal to be in an adversary relationship to myself. Self-assertion brings you further into reality as you express your inner life in words and actions. Self-assertion means that you honor your own needs, judgments, and values. A successful life requires that you translate yourself into action. It doesn't mean that you're the only one with needs or rights, of course. Sometimes you will defer to others, giving their feelings priority. Sometimes you will recognize that their rights may supersede your own. When you do, you are practicing objectivity, not self-sacrifice. Self-awareness begins with learning to be more conscious of your feelings and emotions. As you've heard, this is the area where we learn to shut down from our earliest years. The art of awareness consists of observing without interfering. Initially, for some, this can be a very frightening experience. You may not know why you feel what you do, or what feelings may emerge the next moment. You may experience the panic of being out of control, but panic is just another emotion. As you become more and more conscious of the flow of your feelings, you become more and more conscious of the impulses behind your actions. For example, you learn to notice when you're being driven by fear or anger you may have disowned or not even recognized. You may begin to discover your own projections, such as a repressed hostility within yourself that you falsely attribute to others. You may become more conscious of how your relationships affect you and more sensitive to which activities you should and should not pursue. In terms of expanding self-awareness, there is a difference between experiencing an emotion and merely naming it to yourself. The difference is profound. Suppose I am in a rush, agitated over something connected with my work, and barely aware of my state of mind. My wife asks, "How are you feeling?" I answer a little abruptly, "Fine." And then when I see that she's still looking at me, I add a little more truthfully that I am irritated. My wife says sympathetically, "It looks like you're really feeling upset about something." I sigh, and the tension begins to flow from my body. In an altogether different tone of voice, I say, "Yes, I'm upset about my writing today. I can't seem to get anything right. Everything I put down on paper is choppy and out of focus. I feel worried and miserable." Now I am not trying to outrun my emotions. I am not tensed against them, and I'm not trying to dismiss them by labeling them irritated. I am allowing myself to experience what I feel. In allowing myself to experience my feelings, I am deepening my awareness. Experiencing your emotions rather than just naming them is necessary for self-healing. When we are aware of and experience our unwanted feelings, they tend to diminish. The opposite happens with wanted feelings. They grow stronger. So, if I surrender to my feelings of love for another human being, the love intensifies and inspires behaviors that deepen the love. If I experience fully the joy I take in my work, my passion for my work intensifies, my excitement rises, and I am inspired to give my best. This, in turn, nurtures my love for my work. I often recommend the following exercise for opening oneself to emotional awareness. Simply sit quietly, eyes closed, and breathe deeply and gently through the mouth into the stomach. Pay attention to the smallest details of what you are experiencing within. Just noting and observing, without analysis, without self-criticism. This exercise is simple, but it has great power to awaken feeling. People may find themselves crying, angry, sexually excited, euphoric, depressed, or ecstatic, and in awe of the richness of their emotional life. Another exercise can be done standing up or lying down. Tighten successively all the muscles of your body, moving upwards from the feet, holding the contractions as long as possible, then releasing explosively, letting everything relax at once, allowing the body to breathe as it needs to breathe without interference. Go through the entire procedure 5 or 6 times, then stand or lie down quietly and mentally observe yourself. Breathe into the feelings that arise within you. Don't fight back by tensing muscles against whatever emotions and memories arise. Don't distract yourself by asking questions like, "Should I be feeling this?" or "What does this feeling mean?" or worse still, "What does it imply about me that I am feeling this way?" It is possible that apparently unknown thoughts can be brought into consciousness. Here are some simple examples. We'll begin with hypnosis. It clearly demonstrates that by altering our state of mind, we can gain access to material not normally available. Example: an adult claims to have little or no memory of his early years. When he is hypnotized back in time to the first years of his life, we see his posture and facial expression changing. It's as if he were becoming younger before our eyes. Forgotten or repressed experiences are awakened within him. Usually, he re-experiences or reconnects with events that have been submerged or inaccessible previously to his conscious mind. The altered state of consciousness doesn't create the memories, it allows them to emerge. Another well-known technique for connecting with thoughts we are unaware of involves talking in fantasy to the person with whom we have unfinished business. Here's an example of a different fantasy exercise. Imagine an encounter with a wise old person in a cave or on top of a mountain. This wise being knows the answers you desperately are looking for. In fantasy, you ask questions like, "How am I standing in the way of my own growth?" or "What do I need to do to let go of the pain of the past?" You listen very carefully to the answers. Sometimes they come in words, sometimes in images. And then you meditate on the marvelous and illuminating things you learn from this wise old person who lives inside you. The simplest technique is a strategy I discovered one time late at night. I was feeling a little tired and asked my client a question I was sure he could answer. When he looked at me blankly and said he didn't know, I said jokingly, "Okay, you don't know. But if you knew, what might the answer be?" He then proceeded to answer the question. After he left the office, I remained in my chair, mildly stunned and convinced something important had happened. It was as if the original version of my question had pressured him to be right, and that caused him to lose contact with what he knew. When I conceded that he didn't know, the pressure disappeared, and he felt a freedom that gave him access to the answer. Sometimes when I am stuck on some question or problem I think I should have an answer for, I tell myself, okay, you don't know. But if you knew, what might the answer be? Surprisingly often, something comes to me. Check it out for yourself. When a client says, I don't know. I don't know what I feel. I don't know whether I want to stay married. I don't know what I see in her. I don't know whether I was molested as a child. I assume that a shift in consciousness can often make it possible for him or her to know the answer. The sentence completion technique makes it possible to achieve a shift in consciousness of just the kind that can bring up previously unrecognized information or material. Through this method, you gain access to material that you may not be readily aware of. You can use this technique in a group or working with another person or talking to yourself in a mirror or into a tape recorder or writing in a notebook. In any case, the important thing is to say or write whatever comes to mind freely and spontaneously without worrying about the literal truth or falsehood of any particular ending. Here is a simple sentence completion exercise you can use to begin to explore aspects of your emotional life. Write each of the following stems at the top of a blank page, then do a minimum of 10 endings for each stem just as rapidly as you can, and don't tell yourself you can't do this. Anyone can do this. I have taught this to many thousands of people, and some of them love to start off by saying, I can't do it, and then they proceed to do it, and so can you.
For exploring feelings of pain or hurt.
I can remember feeling hurt when I was hurt, I told myself, sometimes I feel hurt when, sometimes when I am hurt, I, one of the ways I sometimes hide my hurt is, if I ever fully admitted when I feel hurt, a better way to deal with my hurt might be,
for exploring fear.
I can remember feeling afraid when I was afraid, I told myself, one of the ways I sometimes hide my fear is, one of the ways my fear comes out is, if I ever fully admitted when I feel afraid, a better way to deal with my fear might be,
for exploring anger.
I can remember feeling angry when I felt angry, I told myself, sometimes I feel angry when, sometimes when I'm angry, I, one of the ways I hide my anger is, one of the ways my anger comes out is, if I ever fully admitted when I'm angry, a better way to deal with my anger might be,
for exploring sexuality.
Sometimes I feel sexually excited when, sometimes when I'm sexually excited, I, one of the ways I sometimes hide my sexual excitement is, one of the ways my sexual excitement comes out is, if I ever fully admitted when I feel sexually excited, a better way to deal with my sexual excitement might be,
for exploring feelings of joy or happiness.
Sometimes I feel happy when, sometimes when I'm happy, I, one of the ways I sometimes hide my happiness is, one of the ways my happiness comes out is, if I ever fully admitted when I feel happy, a better way to deal with my happiness might be, it's easy to understand the fear that may come with the prospect of encountering painful emotions. But sometimes joy can be threatening too. A woman who had not worked outside her home for many years took a job to add to the family income. Being very competent, she was quickly promoted. But she concealed the extent of her pride and happiness from herself. She intuitively felt it would disturb the balance of her marriage. She sensed that her husband might feel threatened. Participating in one of my weekend workshops, and specifically confronted with the sentence stem, "Sometimes I feel happy when," she was brought face to face with the sudden realization that many of her greatest moments of joy took place at work. She became aware of why she had been blocking and disowning. She began to confront tensions in her relationship with her husband that she'd chosen to overlook. Like a string of exploding firecrackers, one burst of awareness led to another. From a recognition of the kind of programming she had received from her mother about a woman's place, to the amount of boredom she had felt doing her alleged duty, to her previously unadmitted contempt for religious teaching about self-sacrifice, and on and on and on. She reported an enormous increase in self-assurance and internal freedom, even though she was worried about her husband's reaction to her feelings. She said she was willing to face whatever might need to be faced. Her husband was present at the workshop, and from observing him, my guess was that they would be able to work out this transition in her development. We are far better off knowing our needs, emotions, and wants than being oblivious to them. Where there is knowledge, there is the possibility of action. But why might it be good to know about an unmet need from our past, a deep-seated frustration of long ago, where it would seem that action is no longer possible? Very often we resist knowing about a need or want we see no possibility of fulfilling. Our father may have died when we were young. He may have been impossibly distant and remote, unloving and rejecting, or non-supportive. To diminish the pain, we bury the knowledge of how much we would have liked a different kind of father. We tell ourselves, "I'm an adult now, why do I have to think about that?" The only way to complete unfinished business from the past is to give comfort and understanding to the hurt person you once were. Only then can you move into a freer, more harmonious adulthood. This may entail a kind of mourning, a period of allowing yourself to feel the pain you never acknowledged before. It might require a time of talking in fantasy to the child within, leading to the point when the past is finally laid to rest. I mean really laid to rest. To grow up is to assume responsibility for parenting the child within. To further illustrate this point, I offer an experience from my own life. Although I loved my father and our relationship was cordial, we were never close except during the first few years of my life, and to a lesser extent during the last years of his. He was a shy, withdrawn man, completely unable to relate to any of my interests. I wasn't very close to my mother either. I never felt comfortable in school. I was bored and restless a good deal of the time, and I longed for an older person to teach me things, to offer some kind of guidance. After a while, I repressed the longing. I decided it was impractical and turned more and more to my own resources. My sole form of intellectual nurturing was through books. A month before I turned 20, I met and became friendly with novelist-philosopher Ayn Rand. I had greatly admired her book, The Fountainhead. Our association spanned 18 years. I gained a lot from it and was harmed greatly by it. It came to an end in 1968 when I was 38 years old. As with many relationships that begin in the student-mentor mold, our parting of the ways was rather violent. Our differences were both philosophical and personal. I used to wonder why I had remained in the relationship so long, long past the time when it was clear that this relationship had become harmful to me. When I was 40 years old, I finally reconnected with my frustrated childhood longing for a teacher, for a father, for a guide. Only then did I grasp at least one of the powerful forces that had influenced my choices. I remembered that at the age of 20, when my first article was published, I brought Ayn Rand a copy, and because my visit fell on Father's Day, I had autographed my article as a joke to my father, Ayn Rand. It took me 20 years to realize it was not a joke. When I allowed myself not only to recognize my childhood need for a teacher and a guide, but to feel it, it very quickly began to fade. The young boy who had wanted a mentor found him in me. The essence of self-awareness is learning to notice, learning to pay attention. And self-awareness can include a good deal more than I have discussed so far. The pattern of our breathing and the moments when we interrupt its natural rhythm. The tone of our voice and the message our tone conveys. The ways we stand or move and the silent statement contained in our stance and posture. The signals we give through the expression in our eyes and on our face. And beyond that, our dreams and the secrets often encoded within them. Our fantasies and the longings they contain. The self is a vast continent whose exploration we can never complete. I don't want to conclude this discussion of self-awareness without touching briefly on the subject of subselves or subpersonalities. In addition to the adult self that most of us are familiar with, there is within the psyche a child self, the living presence of the child we once were. That child's frame of reference and way of responding lives on in our psyche, but we may have disowned that child long ago, repressing his or her feelings, responses, and perceptions. We may have believed that was necessary so we could grow to adulthood, so that the more advanced forms of self-awareness entail the rediscovery and the re-embracing of the child self within. Another sub-self is the female self in each male and the male self in each female. This self is usually unconscious and disowned. When brought to consciousness, accepted, and integrated, it is an invaluable source for the total personality, a source of growth, expansion, energy, and higher awareness. Each one of us contains within an opposite gender self, that is to say, in man, an internal female principle, in women, an internal male principle. The Swiss psychiatrist Jung suggested that in general, in creative men and women, their opposite gender selves are more highly integrated than is usually the case with average people. These more creative individuals are less willing to disown those aspects of the self that don't conform to conventional sexual stereotypes. They are more open to the totality of their inner being. I mentioned earlier in passing the sage self, or the higher self as it's sometimes called, the wisest, most daring, and most intuitive part of us. That self is often most aware of our deepest needs and our highest possibilities. The sage self may be the voice of evolution within us, the voice that whispers to us in our dreams, or in moments when we are alone, or when listening to great music, or when making passionate love, whispering that our journey is not finished, that it is never finished, that higher possibilities of creativity, joy, and consciousness lie beyond the next mountain range of our awareness. It is easy to ignore it because it is a voice that speaks only in whispers. It doesn't scream the way the child self might scream. While you listen to me speaking now, if you are aware of some resonance within you, a vaguely familiar trembling, that may be the voice of the sage self signaling for your attention. This passing introduction to the issue of subselves simplifies a very complex subject. The various subselves, and there are more than I've mentioned, generate emotional tensions and problems if disowned, denied, repudiated. But if they are recognized and integrated, they can enrich and enliven us. They are magnificent resources. So, internal signals can be sensations, desires, emotions, memories, thoughts, images, or fantasies. Any can be allowed into awareness, and any can be shut out of awareness. Some signals are so faint, they tend to remain unnoticed. Some signals disappear from awareness because we have no frame of reference to understand them by, or they seem to conflict with what we think we know. And some signals are avoided because they threaten our balance, disturb the precarious structure of our security or self-esteem. This is what makes attaining self-awareness a continual challenge. Which leads us, once again, to the all-important subject of self-acceptance. Without self-acceptance, there is a limit to how far self-awareness can proceed. Sometimes we become aware of a feeling, a thought, or a memory, and we begin to tense against it. We feel powerless to control our response. Self-acceptance in that moment seems impossible to us. What to do? The solution is not to try to resist our resistance. If we can't accept a feeling or a thought or a memory, accept the resistance. If we stay with the resistance at the conscious level, it will begin to melt. We become off-center when we try to fight ourselves. When we flow with what is, we regain balance and control. This is the essence of the art of self-acceptance. For example, I have a feeling of anger. I don't want to feel it. I deny it. I can't accept it. Okay, I can accept my non-acceptance. Can I breathe into that? Can I relax into that? That's how we minimize internal conflict. When we fight ourselves, we keep ourselves in a state of conflict and tension. We produce self-alienation. If we permit ourselves to experience what we are denying, we reestablish contact. We make it possible for unwanted feelings to be discharged, and we can maintain our internal balance and well-being. One of my favorite ways to demonstrate this is when someone in therapy or in one of my seminars complains of being unable to speak freely because of an over-eagerness, let's say, to win my approval. Typically, I will ask the person to tell me several times, clearly and firmly, of the desire for my approval. To look at me and say over and over again, Nathaniel, I really want you to approve of me. And to breathe into it and accept it and say it again, I really want you to approve of me. And something that looks like a miracle happens. After 7 or 8 repetitions, the person is almost always relaxed and amazed at the relaxation. He or she will no longer be so preoccupied with gaining my approval because it's been accepted, owned, rather than fought and resisted. The difficulty in speaking openly is caused not by the desire for approval as such, but by resistance to the desire. By expressing the desire either aloud or to ourselves silently, we increase the sense of self-respect and autonomy. We're not afraid of the truth. We own the truth. We embrace the truth. We also free the mind to be aware that there is, after all, a wider context. The most important need in this particular situation is to say what we want rather than to gain approval. We can better practice self-acceptance when we understand that it is not unwanted feelings that get in our way, but the denial and disowning of those feelings. Blocking our feelings impairs solid contact with our inner experience. A woman who does not permit herself to know when she feels assaulted and mistreated condemns herself to feeling helpless and impotent. In this state, self-assertiveness is impossible. A man who doesn't permit himself to know when he is afraid can't be aware of the defenses he has erected that restrict his growth, and so obviously he cannot take any action to correct the situation. Unfortunately, many people who want to change begin by repudiating what they are and looking toward what they want to become. Doesn't work that way. We can't move successfully toward our goals by disowning what we are now. I'll say what I said to you before. You cannot leave a place you have never been. You cannot leave an anger you have never accepted. You cannot let go of a pain you have never experienced. Another example, a personal one, clarifies the relationship between self-acceptance and the self-healing function of the mind. This happened quite a number of years ago when I was writing an early book of mine called The Disowned Self. A young man came to my office to discuss entering therapy with me. He didn't have a lot of money, and coming to Los Angeles had not been easy for him. I liked him, and I found him interesting, but I saw that he needed far more personal attention than I was in a position to give. This was during a time when I was not doing individual therapy, but only group therapy. I had stopped doing individual therapy because I needed more time for my writing. And I explained to him why I couldn't accept him as a client, and I recommended him to a colleague. Although he handled himself with great dignity and composure, I could see that he was sadly disappointed. When he left my office, I felt troubled, depressed, and somewhat guilty. Then I told myself that my feelings were nonsense. I returned to my desk to resume writing and to explain to future readers the importance of accepting their feelings. My feeling of distress continued, despite my impatient efforts at dismissal. Then it suddenly hit me. I appreciated the contradiction between what I was doing in this moment and what I was writing about and recommending to others. I got up from my desk and went to sit on the sofa. I closed my eyes, began to breathe deeply, and whispered to myself, "I'm really feeling bad right now. I feel troubled. I feel miserable. I feel depressed. I'm wondering if I lack compassion because I didn't find a way to stretch my time." I saw the look of sadness in his eyes as he left, and I felt low, terribly low. I didn't need to give myself lectures that I really couldn't afford the time. All I needed was a few minutes to feel what I was feeling. And after a few moments, my troubled feelings were gone. My head cleared, my spirits lifted, I saw the whole situation in realistic perspective, and I serenely returned to work. Integration is central to every aspect of the life process. An organism sustains itself physically by taking materials from the environment, reorganizing them, and converting these materials into its means of survival. In this way, it achieves a new integration. The mind takes in reality in a similar way. It integrates sensations into perceptions, perceptions into concepts, concepts into still wider concepts, and new experiences into conceptual knowledge. Integration is the cardinal principle of life and of mind. To integrate is to unify elements in accordance with a goal, need, or organizing principle. All self-healing at the psychological level entails the principle of integration. For example, the integration of traumatic experiences so they lose their negative charge, or the integration of a single troublesome incident into the bigger picture, like the incident of the young man who came to me for therapy. Evasion and repression, of course, work against integration. When evasion and repression have blocked our process of integration, then reason, self-awareness, and self-acceptance can help remove those obstructions. The ability of the mind to repair itself on the psychological level is impressive. The challenge for those involved in doing psychotherapy is how to use this capacity creatively. Contact with feelings may often begin the process of self-healing, but it is hardly the end of the process. It doesn't automatically bring on the thinking, honesty, integrity, and attitude of self-responsibility that our well-being ultimately requires. We have to be aware of the facts and requirements of external reality and of inner experience without sacrificing one awareness to the other. For example, suppose that a man is ill and knows that he has to have surgery. He experiences a great deal of fear at the prospect of surgery. It would be self-destructive for him to give in to the fear and avoid the surgery. It would also be self-destructive to be oblivious to his fear and only be aware of the need for surgery. A fear that is experienced and acknowledged can be dealt with. A fear that is denied in a case like this could bring on traumatic shock. Or again, suppose that the woman feels enraged at her husband. It is important for her and for the relationship that she be able to accept her rage, to be honest with herself about it. Even if the rage isn't justified, she still has the right to accept it. If she feels it, she feels it. When she accepts and experiences her rage, it is possible and necessary for her to be aware that her rage may or may not be a response to her husband's behavior. Maybe it's the result of unresolved conflicts within herself and has really very little relevance to her husband's behavior. So, two different issues are involved. Both deserve awareness and acknowledgement. One is the fact of her emotional state. The other is the matter of objectivity. What has really happened between her and her husband? Obviously, it's a mistake for her to assume that her rage is justified before she looks at it objectively. But it's also a mistake for her to deny her rage until she can prove that it's justified. In either case, the mistake is the same, avoidance of reality. She can accept her feeling without being obligated to be run by it. Quite simply, self-acceptance is realism. This sums up the whole issue. Self-acceptance is realism. What is. What I feel, I feel. What I think, I think. What I have done, I have done. Reason and emotion do not have to be adversaries and shouldn't be. If rationality entails respect for the facts of reality, that includes the facts concerning our own psychological state. Reason is an instrument of awareness. Reason is the power of integration made explicit and self-conscious. It is the principle which allows us to integrate and organize the contents of our awareness. We don't need to use reason to analyze every single experience, obviously. But often, we have relationships we can't fully understand, or there is a discord among the signals we're receiving from within and without, and reason then must guide the process of integration on an explicit and self-conscious plane. When we try to dissolve conflicts within ourselves, we sometimes need to reflect on the meaning of our feelings, responses, and actions. We have to engage in the sustained process of reasoning. Sometimes, on the other hand, we just need to bring some aspect of our experience into awareness. In any case, only reason can determine which course of mental action is appropriate. So in that sense, reason always has the last word. If you understand this concept of reason and rationality, you can appreciate that self-acceptance is the application of the principle of reason to the world of inner experience.